Greetings, this is Robert Noya, Editor-in-Chief of Sky and Telescope Magazine. I'm on the phone with Trudy E. Bell, a multiple award-winning science journalist and astronomy historian who also serves as a presidential fellow at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. Trudy authored Sky and Telescope's June 2011 feature article titled The Great Telescope Race. This article explains how the United States in the 1800s transformed itself from a scientific backwater into an astronomical juggernaut, possessing more telescopes and better telescopes than any nation in human history up to that time. Trudy, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much, Bob.
So when you titled the article, The Great Telescope Race, who is racing whom and what were they aiming for?
Well, it was most pointed between the United States and Great Britain. The New World taking on the Old World for the distinction of having the world's largest telescope.
Okay. And why were refractors preferred at the time? And, you know, why was like a refractor of 15-inch aperture considered, you know, a, quote, big telescope in the middle part of the 19th century?
Well, there were bigger reflectors. William Herschel, in the 1780s, had constructed his 40-foot telescope. But that mirror was made of something called speculum metal. The bad thing about speculum metal is that it tarnished very rapidly within a matter of weeks. And it could be very brittle and very difficult to work. And the reason that refractors were not made very big in the 18th century is that you had to have a couple of discs of glass that were clear enough that you could look through them without distorted images. And they had trouble making the discs of glass very large until the early 19th century. A glass maker figured out a way, a trade secret for casting larger discs of glass, and that was really what was the turning point for the refractor, when people started making them bigger and bigger.
Mm-hmm. You know, in 1845, the Harvard 15-inch telescope was built. And it seems like that event, along with, you know, the Cincinnati Observatory and a few others, really got this whole telescope race kick-started, and that's when the United States really started to take off in telescopes construction. What brought the United States to that kind of takeoff point?
Well, back before 1820, some scientists had felt that the United States was way behind England, astronomically speaking, and they viewed an astronomical observatory as, you know, the peak of attainment and of showing what kind of scientific nation the United States could be. And so by the 1830s, several observatories had been founded in the United States. And you're right. With the installation of the Harvard 15-inch, the United States had one of the twin largest observatories in the world.
Mm-hmm. The telescope movement got started in the, you know, early to middle part of the 1800s. And then kind of it really started to pick up with momentum, and firms such as Alvin Clark and Sons and Warner and Swasey became real giants in this telescope building movement, where like every few years it seems they'd set a new record for world's largest telescope. Like, what was it about these particular firms that really drove them and allowed them to be so successful and productive?
Well, Alvin Clark was a very interesting case. I think there are a couple of things that helped him get started. I mean, first off, his biggest competitor, who also ground and polished quite a number of lenses, but he had an untimely death. But Clark also made really, really superb telescopes. He became world famous with his world's largest refractor, which was the Dearborn Observatory, and then he kept getting all these famous contracts, like he did the 26-inch for the U.S. Naval Observatory, the 30-inch later for the Pulkova Observatory, the 36-inch for Lick Observatory, and finally the firm, after the death of the Clark Sr., did the 40-inch for the Yerkes Observatory in the 1890s. So basically from about 1860 to 1890, he was just really famous size and the quality of his work. But Warner and Swayze, they took a totally engineering approach, which was an innovative and new approach. You have to remember, this was the time of the Industrial Revolution. The idea of interchangeable parts and precision measurements and everything was relatively new. Actually, they went directly from mounting a 9-inch telescope for the Beloit Observatory to mounting the 36-inch telescope at Lick Observatory. And again, since they mounted a world's largest, that put them on the map. And so they just became the gold standard, both Clark for the optics and Warner and Swayze for the mechanics.
Right. And it was interesting, too. It wasn't just the fact that lots of telescopes were being built. I mean, the U.S. was building really big telescopes. You know, I know from reading that those were really the products of very wealthy business tycoons. What happened, like, toward the latter part of the century that really enabled these really giant telescopes to get built?
Well, a lot of the people who were financing telescopes did not necessarily have an intrinsic interest in astronomy. There were religious motives and cultural motives, one-upsmanship motives that fueled the desire of many benefactors, many philanthropists, to found the largest observatory in the world, or if not the largest. If they didn't have enough money to found the largest, they wanted to do the highest, or the first in their state, or the farthest west, or have some other claim to fame, because a telescope became a symbol of cultural attainment, where the new world could triumph over the old, to the point where there were several European astronomers who came to the United States and were astounded at how many members of the general public would flock to American observatories and want to look through the telescope. And finally, at the end of the 19th century, there was an article that came out in Nature magazine where one British writer said British observatories might receive more support if it were not for the perception that the best work and the best equipment is in America. That must have been vindication as sweet.
One thing I found interesting, you know, your article was really about the 19th century, but this telescope movement didn't just end when the century turned. Once we got into the 1900s, the big scopes were no longer refractors. They became reflectors. What brought about the change from going from giant refractors to giant reflectors, a movement that continues to this day?
Well, the refractors themselves, just as I remember with the speculum metal mirrors, had limitations, similar limit was reached with the refractors. Once you get lenses that are 40 inches or more across, there are a lot of problems. First off, the lens gets so thick that it starts cutting out a lot of light. Secondly, it starts sagging under its own weight when the telescope is moved from, you know, one angle to another. And thirdly, just the whole engineering problem of working four surfaces is much greater than working one surface. And in the, I think the 1870s or 80s, I don't remember the exact date, astronomers figured out how to make a silver-on-glass telescope. And that silver-on-glass reflector was the turning point for the reflector.
Right. And I, you know, as I was working on your article, I was really thinking about how exciting it must have been if you're someone enthusiastic about astronomy in the 1800s with these really incredible developments. And then I'm trying to contrast it to today. You know, I'm kind of worried that this tremendous progress that we've seen in astronomy, that that might be maybe not completely grinding to a halt, but the momentum really slowing down in the years ahead.
I think that in the 19th century, there was something that we don't have today, and that is dark skies. Now, with the ever-present light in cities or even in rural areas, it's hard to even keep track of the phase of the moon in some places, particularly if you live like in New York City. I think that people aren't aware of how half their environment is directly over their head. Since funding ultimately depends on voters, giving them hands-on experience themselves with telescopes and with the wonders of the universe, I think can do wonders for getting people to write letters of support. And here, once again, we can come back to the 19th century observatories, because many of these observatories have public observing nights. And the thing about the refractors are that they are so impressive. You walk in, they're like a magnificent antique. The vintage observatories and telescopes can fascinate children and get them to be interested in science and fascinate the parents who want to find out more about it and, you know, then be more responsive to the idea of why it's so important that we learn more about this universe that we live in.
Okay, well, I certainly hope you're right on that front. That probably should take care of things for now. I want to really thank you for taking the time to speak with us and also for writing such a fine article for Sky Intel. And I hope you'll write another article for us sometime in the future.
I will take you up on that. Thank you very much for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Okay, well, you're welcome. My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye.